Hello, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association podcast entitled 2017 Supreme Court and Federal Court Update. I'm Sarah Schwartz, A-List CLE Associate, and it's my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Robert Powell, A-LA author of Litigating Immigration Cases in Federal Court from Seattle, Washington. Joining Robert are Laura Lichter, A-LA past president from Denver, Colorado, and Matthew Guardano from New York, New York. Speakers have carefully selected materials for this podcast, which can be found in your Agora Digital Library. Go to agora.ala.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page of your digital library, you'll see two files, one audio file, and right above or below are the resources. If you have any questions, please email agora@ala.org. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Robert.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and also thank you to Laura and Matthew for joining us today. We will be talking about several recent developments, a couple of Supreme Court decisions, and also lower court decisions. The first point that I would make is that our discussion will be what we offer is an overview of some issues, and in a somewhat oversimplified manner. It's really not possible to get into all of the details and all of the nuances of the different cases and the different issues that we'll be looking at. So, of course, our listeners need to know, which I'm sure they'll do, is that to take a look carefully at the cases. When you're working on any particular case or any particular issue, of course, you'll need to take a look at the cases that we're talking about carefully, as well as additional research. We certainly do not have the time to go into all of the relevant case law on these issues. So again, what we hope to offer is an overview of some of the issues to be thinking about in these cases. I'll start first talking about some developments in the context of what's called categorical analysis, the analysis that's used to determine whether or not a person is deportable based on a conviction of one sort or another. The categorical analysis has received a lot of attention lately, and there have been important developments in this area. So just by way of example then, I want to make sure that first of all we understand generally what the categorical analysis is and the methodology used in the categorical analysis. So let's consider whether a person is deportable as an aggravated felon for having been convicted of burglary with a sentence of 1 year or more. So that's in section 101A43G, which lists burglary as a potential aggravated felony. So the categorical analysis, first of all, requires us to take a look at what's called the generic federal definition of, in this case, burglary is. And then we want to compare that definition with the statute under which the person was convicted. So by way of example then, burglary, the generic federal definition of burglary includes three elements. First of all, an unlawful or unprivileged entry, and second, into a building or other structure, and third, with intent to commit a crime. So if a person is going to be deported as an aggravated felon for having been convicted of a burglary offense, we have to make sure that the person's conviction meets those three elements. If the person is convicted under a state statute or other statute that is broader than the generic federal definition, then we assume that the person was not, in fact, convicted of the narrower generic federal definition of burglary. So by way of example, we can look at California Penal Code Section 459, the California definition of burglary. Suppose that a person is convicted in California state of burglary. Well, the California definition of burglary includes entering into a store that's open to the public with intent to shoplift. So that a person can be convicted Now maybe, you know, in actual fact, a person is convicted for breaking into a home and terrorizing the inhabitants there and intending to steal or kidnap somebody, or whatever the situation may be. Maybe a very heinous crime that the person is, a very heinous offense that the person actually commits. But if he's convicted of burglary for that particular offense, then we assume that he's convicted of the least offensive act under the California statute, which would, you know, which could include something like going into a store to shoplift something. Because that the California statute is broader, much broader than the generic federal definition, we cannot conclude that the person has been convicted under the generic federal definition of burglary, and hence the person would not be deportable for having been convicted of an aggravated felony, under the burglary provision. That result can seem rather counterintuitive. In some cases, in our example, the offense may be very heinous, and it may actually, the underlying facts may really constitute burglary under the generic federal definition. But that doesn't matter. Again, the categorical analysis requires that you look not at the facts of the case, but at the state statute of conviction that the person was convicted under. There are a couple, that analysis goes back to the Taylor versus United States case back in 1990, parenthetically. We do have written materials, and so the cases that we talk about today are referred to and cited in these written materials, which will be available to our listeners. The Taylor case, and also most recently the Mathis versus United States case, a Supreme Court decision in 2016. An important case in the context of this categorical analysis. Now, it turns out that sometimes it might not be possible to determine exactly what state statute the person is convicted under. This leads into what's called the modified categorical analysis. Sometimes a statute will be what is called divisible. So, for example, in a particular state, burglary may be defined as follows: any person who, with intent to commit a felony, either, and then the statute may provide different subdivisions, either A, enters a house or other structure without permission, or B, enters into any land, water, or air vehicle without permission, and any person who meets either one of those would be guilty of burglary. Now, if the person is convicted under subsection A, entering a house or other structure, that would meet the generic federal definition. The person would be guilty of burglary and may be an aggravated felon under section 101A43G. On the other hand, if the person is convicted under that second subsection, entering any land, water, or air vehicle, that's broader than the federal definition of burglary. The federal definition of burglary does not include entry into a vehicle. And so then, you know, the question is, well, is the person convicted under subsection A or subsection B? In order to make that determination, the court, under the modified categorical analysis, will allow the judge to take a look at the record of conviction. That's important. Now, you do not look at the underlying facts and circumstances of the case. You only look at the state criminal record, what's called the record of conviction, which would include the information or complaint against the person, typically the guilty plea and the judgment of sentence, and perhaps an additional document or two that's actually in the record of the state conviction. If you can look at those documents and determine which subsection the person is convicted of, then you will know whether he's or she has been convicted of burglary in the federal sense or not convicted of burglary in the federal sense. That record of conviction is used only for determining which subsection the person is convicted under, and not for anything else. You cannot use those documents to sort of guess at or determine what the underlying facts and circumstances were and then try to determine whether or not the person is deportable based on what you're assuming the underlying facts and circumstances were. The record of conviction is used only to determine which particular statutory provision the person is convicted of. Again, that's that modified categorical analysis comes out of the Taylor case and the Shepard versus United States case, a 2005 Supreme Court decision. And again, the Mathis case, this recent Mathis case out of the Supreme Court in 2016 is also very helpful in explaining that modified categorical analysis. Now, one third point that I want to make about the categorical analysis is a recent distinction between what's called elements and means. Sometimes you can look at a state statute of conviction and you might not be able to tell whether there are actually two separate criminal offenses that are being defined or whether it's just one general offense that's being defined in the state statute of conviction. Well, what do I mean by that? Suppose that a person is convicted in Iowa State of burglary. So in Iowa State, burglary is defined as having the intent to commit a felony, commit a crime, entering an occupied structure, such occupied structure not being open to the public. The question then is, what is an occupied structure under Iowa law? Well, an occupied structure can include a building, but it also includes any land, water, or air vehicle. So in Iowa, theoretically, it's possible to be convicted under that state statute of burglary where what you do is enter, for example, a car and steal something. That, of course, does not meet the generic federal definition of burglary because the general federal definition includes only entry into a building or other structure, non-movable structure. So how do you know whether under Iowa law, Iowa is defining two different statutes, statute provisions for offenses, or whether it's just one single offense? How do you know whether you can look at the record of conviction to determine what the person has been convicted of or not? Well, in the Mathis case, what the Supreme Court does is distinguish between what are called elements and what are called means of committing the offense. So, for example, let's explain that. Let's suppose that a person is arrested in Iowa State for burglary, and he's arrested at a residence where there's a car parked in the driveway. And there's a dispute in the case about whether the person actually entered the house and stole something or stole something out of the car. Now, if the jury instructions, or if under state law, it doesn't matter whether you entered the house or whether you entered the vehicle, then that would just be one general burglary statute. So, for example, you know, maybe half the people on the jury, if it's a jury trial, think that he entered the house, and half the people think that he entered a car. And if you can convict without resolving that question, then the Iowa burglary statute is really just one general statutory provision that covers both entry into houses and entry into vehicles. And then, of course, that one general burglary statute is broader than the federal conviction, than the federal definition, and so the person is not guilty of general federal burglary. On the other hand, if Iowa state law requires that the jury has to be unanimous in determining that the person was convicted either for entering the house, or unanimous in determining that he entered into a vehicle, then the statute really defines two different offenses under Iowa law, and then you use the modified categorical analysis. You look at the record of conviction to determine whether the person was convicted of entering a house, in which case that would be burglary, or on the other hand, if he was convicted of entering a vehicle, in which case it's not burglary. And so you look at what are called the elements of the offense versus the means. If it's just one general statute and you can violate that statute by different means, then it turns out to be broader than the general federal definition, and it's not burglary. On the other hand, if there are two separate statutory provisions with different elements, then you use the record of conviction to determine which statutory provision you were convicted of. So that, I think, in terms of the recent developments in the categorical analysis. I don't know if Laura or Matthew, if you want to add anything or make any clarifications about that, but that's, I think, what comes out of most recently the Mathis case. Again, a very important and a very illuminating decision by the Supreme Court in 2016. But if not, then I would go on. You know, this categorical analysis is very helpful not only in the context of burglary, but any of the other aggravated felony provisions, and also in the other criminal grounds of deportation and inadmissibility. And I know there have been some developments in the context of convictions for controlled substance offenses, and I'll ask Matthew about that. If you can describe how that categorical analysis is or can be used in the context of convictions for controlled substance offenses.
Sure. First thing I want to comment is that there have been dramatic changes in categorical approach analysis in the last couple of years, and it's really changed the way these issues are looked at. And you know, there's no greater example of that than determining whether or not a state controlled substance offense is a removable offense under the Immigration Nationality Act. Basically we have four Immigration Nationality Act provisions that make reference to the term controlled substance as defined in Section 102 of the Controlled Substance Act. 102 of the Controlled Substance Act can be found at 21 U.S.C. Section 802. And that provision is essentially a list. It's a list of controlled substances that are prohibited, and under the federal law, if you have a conviction relating to one of those offenses, you should be removable. Talking about like changes in how we view the categorical approach, for years it was generally thought that if you had a statutory provision that had a list of ways the statute could be violated, and some of them were removable and some were not, the general belief was that was a divisible statute where you needed to apply the modified categorical approach to. However, as Bob pointed out, under Mathis, it's not so easy anymore. And what you're supposed to do is use this elements versus means test. The board. Before I get further into that, I wanted to talk about a board decision called Matter of Ferrara. And in this board decision, the board talked about how basically applying the categorical approach, you're supposed to look at the least means necessary to violate the statute, and if the least means necessary to violate the statute is not a removable offense, then categorically it's not a removable offense. And in Matter of Ferrara, the board said that your least means, there has to be a realistic probability that you that the statute can be violated in that way. And matter of Ferrara involved the Connecticut controlled substance statute. And under the Connecticut controlled substance statute, there were two controlled substances on their list of banned substances. I'll attempt to pronounce it. Benzyl fentanyl and phenylfentanyl were on the Connecticut list, but they weren't on the federal list. And the argument was that the state statute was overbroad, that it included more conduct than the federal statute. And what the board said was that particular individual failed to show that there was a realistic probability that someone could be convicted of benzyl fentanyl and phenylfentanyl. Since the board's decision, we've had a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court called Mullooly versus Lynch. And that was the drug paraphernalia case where they said that a sock could be drug paraphernalia, and the Supreme Court rejected the finding that a sock could be drug paraphernalia. In the Supreme Court's decision about what was a controlled substance offense, they did not use the realistic probability test. And because the Supreme Court in Mullooly didn't use the realistic probability test, the argument is that the Ferrara has been implicitly overturned, and that it's not necessary to make a showing of realistic probability in these categorical approach cases. And that's important because if you're going to argue that your state has some obscure drug that's not on the federal list, you don't have to show a realistic probability that someone could be convicted of having possessed or sold that obscure drug. Next comes into play is Bob talked about Mathis and the elements versus means test, and I was talking before about lists, and essentially, you know, these controlled substance statutes generally tend to be lists of, you know, it's you shall not possess, and then there's like a long list of drugs, and under the elements versus means test, you look to essentially. Is this long list of drugs, are they elements or are they means? And if they're means, then the statute is not divisible and you use the categorical approach. If they're elements, then the modified categorical approach is used, in which case then ICE can look to the charging document in the criminal case to establish what the drug was. There was a recent case out of the Second Circuit, Harbin versus Sessions, where the Second Circuit held that criminal sale of a controlled substance under New York Penal Law 220.31 was categorically not an aggravated felony offense or a controlled substance offense. And there's this drug, I always struggle at saying it, chorionic gonadropin is banned under the New York Penal Law, but it's not banned under the Controlled Substance Act. So the New York Penal Law was broader than the federal law, and the issue in the Second Circuit case was whether or not the New York Penal Law provision is essentially a means or an element with regard to their list of controlled substances. And the Second Circuit concluded that this long list of these various drugs that comprise controlled substance offenses in New York, the Second Circuit concluded that the list was a means and not an element. And what the Second Circuit did was they looked at the punishment, and the punishment was the same no matter which controlled substance you were convicted of being involved with. And the second thing they did, and this is something that's usually important for means versus elements analysis, is the Second Circuit looked at case law and jury instructions to see if it was required that the jury agree upon the specific controlled substance for there to be a conviction. And under New York State case law, interestingly enough, for to be convicted of this specific penal law provision, the jury didn't have to come to a conclusion as to which specific controlled substance was involved. So because it's not required to show which controlled substance is involved, this list of controlled substances is considered to be a means, and since it's a means, the categorical approach is used, not the modified categorical approach. And so since there's something on the state list that's not on the federal list, the state statute is overbroad and is categorically not the same as the federal statute, so that basically anyone who's convicted of this specific New York State penal law provision has categorically not been convicted of an aggravated felony offense, and it's categorically not a controlled substance offense. Okay,
I wonder if you can, Matthew, have thoughts about whether that the Second Circuit decision in Harbin and the analysis of the New York state law carries over then to other states, or what we need to be thinking about in, let's say, trying to apply that if we're in Pennsylvania or Iowa or wherever we might be.
Okay. Well, first thing you got to do is look at is your state statute broader than the federal statute? Does your state statute include drugs that are not on the federal controlled substance list? If yes, then we can go on to the next set of analysis, which is that the elements versus means analysis, meaning can someone be convicted under this statute? Does it matter which drug they're convicted of under this statute? You know, and if it doesn't matter which drug they're convicted of under the state statute, then it's not a divisible statute. The categorical approach is used, and just like the analysis in Harbin, that state statute will not be a controlled substance offense under the immigration laws.
And I wonder if you can say a little bit more. So on that second step, then determining whether it's means or elements, or what do you look at? You know, what sort of evidence might be relevant in determining whether the statute describes means or the statute uses elements to describe two different offenses?
The ideal way of doing it is to look at jury instructions and what is required for a conviction, and if you have your statute that has a list of things, if it doesn't matter in the jury instructions what item on the list is found, then that's going to be considered a means. If the jury instructions require a specific finding from that statutory list, then it's going to be considered an element. And if it's considered an element, then modified categorical approach is used, and ICE can look to the charging document, the indictment, or the complaint.
Okay, good. Do you know, I don't myself, but do you know whether this argument has been successful in other states or other parts of the country?
As far as I know, it's the Second Circuit so far, although I could be wrong on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't heard. I know the argument is out there, but I haven't seen other.
The Second Circuit doesn't reference any other circuits having rendered the decision, but mm-hmm. I thought, for some reason, I had thought that there was another circuit that had rendered a similar decision, but in preparing for today, I couldn't find any other decisions.
And I would jump in and say, at least anecdotally, when we've tried that here in Denver in the Tenth Circuit, we're getting mixed results. And so I think it might just depend on who your IJ is, and how hard they're fighting your case.
Yeah. But I think going back to something I said, I think a lot of it depends on when it was decided, because there's been so much development on this. I mean, Mathis is a 2016 case, and so if Mullooly 2015. So if you were doing this before those two decisions, you might not have gotten a favorable result in the past. Like the Ferrara case, it wasn't decided that long ago, but it was 2014, but it was decided before Mullooly, and if that case were heard today, there would probably be a different outcome. And that's one of the problems with these things, is that so much has happened in the last 2 years that it's kind of hard to keep up with this stuff, and that literally litigating this today, there should be a different result than there should have been 3 years ago, and it's one of the reasons why immigration law is just so important to keep up on things, because if you're not keeping up on things, you blink, you miss something important.
Yeah, I found that not only this area of categorical analysis, which I find quite complicated and, as you said, changing a lot, but other areas as well, including one that we'll talk about here in a few minutes in the area of motions to reopen. But before we get there, what about, I know, Matthew, you've done some work on aggravated felonies that do or do not require a connection to interstate commerce, and I wonder if you can explain what the issue, the considerations are in that type of case.
Okay. If you look at the aggravated felony provision, INA 101A43, it's essentially a list. It's a list that goes from 101A43 little a through 101A43 big A through 101A43 big U. It's essentially a list. And then at the end of the list is this little paragraph, and they call this paragraph there's a little paragraph at the end. It's called the penultimate sentence, because it's at the end. And in the penultimate sentence, it says that an offense is an aggravated felony if it's on this list, irrespective of whether it violates federal, state, or foreign law. And if you look at the various aggravated felony provisions, there are references to federal penal law provisions. And some of these federal penal law provisions make references to interstate commerce. And there were two board decisions, matter of Vasquez-Munoz, which dealt with a California firearms conviction that did not involve interstate commerce. And the board in that case held that the interstate commerce reference is something that's jurisdictional, and because it's jurisdictional, it's an element that can be ignored. And so all you need to see is whether or not the state offense meets all the elements of the federal offense except for the interstate commerce offense. There was a second board decision called Matter of Bautista, where the board looked at a state arson offense and concluded that even though this state arson offense did not refer to interstate commerce, they found that it was an aggravated felony offense based on an aggravated felony provision 101A43 big E little I, which references 18 U.S.C. section 844F, which is arson committed in interstate commerce. And once again, the board said that the interstate commerce provision is something that's jurisdictional and it can be ignored. I thought that was wrong. It just seems like when you think about the categorical approach, you're not supposed to ignore elements. You're supposed to look at all the elements. So I wound up having a client who had this issue, and I wound up taking it all the way to the United States Supreme Court in a case called Luna Torres versus Lynch. And it was a wonderful, fantastic experience getting to argue before the United States Supreme Court. Unfortunately, I did not win. basically the Supreme Court sided with the board decided that using what they call contextual approach, that for this penultimate sentence to have meaning, basically the interstate commerce provision should be ignored, and so that throughout the INA, these provisions, the provisions of the aggravated felony statute that make reference to these federal statutes that involve interstate commerce, basically, if you have a state conviction that involve the same thing, you can be convicted of an aggravated felony even though the offense you committed does not have an interstate commerce provision. We have written materials. I have like the full list of things in INA 101A43 that reference federal crimes that are committed in interstate commerce, but among the biggies in this list is there's kidnapping offenses, sexual exploitation of a child, and transportation of a person for prostitution. These are among the federal offenses that are in that list that have to be committed in interstate commerce, that if you're committed of a similar state offense, you would be convicted of an aggravated felony even though your state offense doesn't have an interstate commerce provision. And this makes it kind of frustrating for those of us who give advisals to criminal lawyers or criminal defendants about the immigration consequences of a criminal plea, because for people who have these state criminal charges, now immigration lawyers, they have to know what all these references to Title 18 are in the aggravated felony provision, so that when people come to say, hey, can I take this plea, you can advise them as to whether or not it's an aggravated felony. It used to be before this case came along, you know, it was just, you know, is it a crime of violence? Is it a theft offense? Is it a burglary offense? You know, it was easy to know those things off the top of your head. Now you need to know all these Title 18 offenses, what they involve, and you need to be able to spot if someone comes to you and they have a state criminal charge, whether or not that state criminal charge is one of these Title 18 offenses.
Is there? Yeah, that's really an important point, one that I hadn't really focused on much before. But I wonder if you think, Matthew, that there's – so it seems to me in some cases, you know, where this interstate requirement is imposed for a federal conviction, that's done not – just as a jurisdictional matter, but as a way to enhance a penalty. For example, you know, if you kidnap.
Oh yeah, I argue that to the Supreme Court.
Do you think there's any room for that argument to be made in other AGFEL context, or do you think that argument is completely gone now?
Yeah, I hate to be pessimistic, and I hate to say, you know, things are foreclosed, but you know. That was the decision. The decision that was rendered by the Supreme Court by Justice Kagan was fairly well thought out, and you know I think it was intended to foreclose any future arguments. And you know I think that as of right now, as far as I'm aware of, this issue is over, and I'm not sure that there's any room for fighting this.
So, and just to clarify this, so just for example, kidnapping, I had previously analyzed that or thought of that as, potentially a crime of violence, and so you would not be convicted of an AGFEL unless there was a sentence of a year or more.
That's what exactly happened to my client with he had an arson conviction where he got probation, and that was exactly the thinking that hey, this isn't going to be a crime of violence because the sentence was only probation, and he has an aggravated felony conviction now and is ineligible for relief.
Yeah, because the arson, for example, or the kidnapping provision does not require any. It's an aggravated felony, even if you get no jail time at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I think really a significant development, and as you say, really important now for advising people on taking a plea or not. You've just got to make sure that it doesn't fall under any one of those. No matter what sentence you get, it doesn't fall under any of the interstate provisions in the federal statute.
Yeah. The interesting thing is there's a lot of overlap in these things. There's a lot of times these are particularly very serious offenses, and generally the sentence is going to wind up being over a year, so that, you know, there will be overlap with the crime of violence. Of course, what we'll be discussing a little later, maybe crime of violence won't be a problem for these people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a tough thing, and I think that it's a very unfair decision, because there's an expression in statutory interpretation about creating a statute, that courts are not supposed to create a statute, and this is just language that's just not there, and the court in this particular case, to me, is they're creating a statute, which makes things, you know, very unfair that people have state convictions that don't have elements of the removal offense, and they're removable. You know, it's just not the way things are supposed to be done, and it's a very ugly twist on the categorical approach.
Yeah. So another relatively recent Supreme Court case is the Mata case. Laura, I wonder if you can just lay out for us what that case is about, what that case decides.
Sure, thanks, Bob. And I think maybe the most important thing in all of these issues that we're raising is to keep in mind that there has been really a lot of recent developments, for the most part, it may give you some fodder for challenging something that you might not otherwise have looked at, and that's particularly true when we look at motions to reopen. So the Mata decision is relatively recent. It's not super fresh now. This is a decision from 2015. But in Mata, we had the case of an individual who had attempted to reopen a case past the 90-day filing deadline in the regulations. The board declined to do that. And when it went up the Fifth Circuit, essentially said that it lacked jurisdiction to consider that appeal from the board's decision because the original motion to reopen by this individual was untimely. The underlying conduct of the lawyer was quite egregious. I don't think anyone would have looked at what went on below and thought that this guy had a fair day in court, but he ended up in another one of those weird little eddies of immigration law where you can show that essentially you got screwed by the system and nobody thinks that they can or should do anything about it. Fortunately, though, when Mata was actually before the Supreme Court, found that the Fifth Circuit did have jurisdiction, and I think the bottom line takeaway on this, rather than getting into all of the different jurisdictional issues and theories that are brought in these cases, is that essentially if there is a missed filing deadline that can be, especially in this case, was tied to ineffective assistance of counsel, then the courts of appeal do actually have the ability to review that decision from the board. This is the type of case that I think really depends on where you practice, both in terms of how generous maybe your IJ level review is, and how the board might review those cases if it goes up that far, as well as your circuit court review, because as you know, the devil's in the detail in these cases. You may have a situation where For example, equitable tolling is recognized, but maybe your case arises in the 11th Circuit, and you're really in a difficult position showing the requisite level of prejudice to be successful. So with Mata, we did at least put to bed the question about timing and whether or not there was equitable tolling recognized throughout the country. But I think the way to understand that decision is looking at it really in that there are three parts to the review. One is that the timing for filing a case can be reviewed, but it is a separate question in every case on a case-by-case basis and subject probably to nuances in each individual circuit's case law as to whether tolling is proper. And that, again, beyond that, even if you are successful in establishing that tolling is proper in your particular case, you still have to show that you have met the merits of the underlying motion in order to be successful in that motion to reopen.
So then Mata sort of opens up at least the possibility of getting judicial review of a denial of the motion to reopen. What about a case, let's say, and I have several of these cases, so thinking about working through them, a case in which a person gets deported and then reenters illegally subject to reinstatement, but the person appears to have a good basis for a motion to reopen, whatever the basis might be. You know, for example, the one just Matthew was just talking about, where maybe the person was ordered deported on the basis of a controlled substance offense, and it turns out now after Mullooly and Harbin that, well, he really shouldn't have been deported on that basis, or whatever the situation might be. But, you know, you have a good basis for a motion to reopen. What do you think about what are the considerations here for deciding whether or not to go ahead and file a motion to reopen?
Yeah, so these are really, really difficult situations, I think, that we're going to see people confronted with, frankly, more and more. And a lot of this has as much to do with current prosecutorial and enforcement priorities as it does with what current case law is. I'm sure that many of us are used to taking something where it looks to us like, gosh, this is a no-brainer, and, you know, maybe shopping it to our local chief counsel's office, talking to ERO and getting them maybe to hold off on the reinstatement or getting them to join in a motion. But it may be that at least for the near future, and hopefully that is a limited future, those sorts of options may not be available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bob raises one of these questions which leaves, good immigration lawyers pulling out what little hair they have left these days. Because if you have somebody and you can see that they do in fact have a really good basis for a motion to reopen, you know, you've got good basis for tolling, you've got good merits underlying it, but what do you do about the fact that they're reinstatable? And the short answer is, well, there's a whole lot of arguments out there, but there's unfortunately not been huge success in some of these. And I think first, before we start talking about the reinstatement cases, it's worth sort of reminding people that the context that involves the regulatory departure bar is worth being familiar with before you wade into these waters. So as I'm sure most of you are aware, there is a regulatory bar to reopening after departure, and this is something that the BIA has upheld and has just clung to, even though basically at this point in time it has been rejected by, I think it's every single circuit, the only circuit that is left open on the legitimacy of this regulatory departure bar is the Eighth Circuit. So if you're any place else but the Eighth Circuit, you're not worrying about the fact that your attempt to reopen a prior proceeding has been interrupted or prejudiced by the fact that your client may have either left or been removed. That shouldn't be something that necessarily bars your ability to bring that motion. And then even if you are unfortunately having to deal with something that's in the Eighth Circuit, then what we suggest and what we have done is, well, let me back up. You may find that the board maybe is a little sensitive to the fact that this is the only circuit in which this rule still apparently applies, and they often just don't go there, whether they explicitly decline to invoke that or whether your decision comes back mysteriously devoid of any reference to it. It's a lot of what we've seen recently does not invoke the departure bar, even in the Eighth Circuit cases. You may want to attempt in those cases also to ask the board to strike the regulation in the interest of a uniform application of the immigration laws if you're faced with that sort of a situation. But if we're talking about the fact pattern that Bob brings up, where this person with this absolutely picture-perfect, lovely, sympathetic motion to reopen also happens to be subject to reinstatement. Those are tough. Understand that the reinstatement statute is pretty clear. INA 241A5 states that the prior order of removal is reinstated from its original date, and it's not subject to being reopened or reviewed. So there's this explicit, very clear, essential slamming of the door to trying to reopen a prior order. And we've seen, for example, the decision in Cordova Soto versus Holder, which is a 2013 decision out of the Seventh Circuit, that essentially somebody who has been reinstated faces a permanent bar to reopening any prior underlying order. Now, some courts have allowed review of legal claims after reinstatement, relying on the savings clause for petitions review at 8 U.S.C. 1252A2D. And, for example, you could see a case that we end up relying on often here in the Tenth Circuit, Mendiola versus Holder, 2014 case, basically saying this gives the court the jurisdiction to consider legal challenges even if the original order has already been reinstated. These are touchy cases, though. If I had somebody walk into my office today with the aforementioned beautiful motion to reopen, I might pull together my very best effort to approach OCC with a request for a joint motion, knowing that if they said no, that my client is either continues and maybe even more at risk of actually being reinstated if they're not already in ICE custody. Or I might be in a position where I would be asking my client to consider departing the country so that they weren't actually subject to reinstatement, and then filing the motion to reopen. Hopefully I've got all my I's dotted and T's crossed as far as timing and whatever other issues are at play in my motion. Hoping that I would be successful in front of the board or the IJ if it's at that level, and then going on up the food chain. But by asking my client to consider waiting for the adjudication of the motion outside the United States, I may be putting them in a position where they're less likely to be reinstated. And if they're not reinstated, perhaps I can avoid this slamming of the door to review of that underlying order. So that's one possibility. With these types of cases as well, I think I would be very, very careful in bringing them in the first place. But, you know, honestly, these days, what are we seeing? We're seeing a lot of clients who are already in reinstatement, or these are people who maybe would be subject to reinstatement, but because of shifting enforcement priorities, maybe were previously only being allowed to stay in the United States subject to lengthy and repeated stays through ICE. And if you're in a situation where you literally can't have the luxury of avoiding the reinstatement, then you may want to consider some other ways of potentially delaying that, whether you're actually challenging the reinstatement based on a gross miscarriage of justice. I think gross miscarriage of justice is somewhat of a unicorn. They're few and far between, and there may be what looks to me or you like a gross miscarriage of justice doesn't seem to make a dent to most circuit courts. The other ideas that we have had in some cases is if there is a bona fide claim to some sort of protection under CAT or withholding, doing a request for a reasonable fear interview. At a minimum, there's a very good argument that there is no reinstatement order unless and until those withholding proceedings have been terminated. And perhaps you may be in a situation where you can be even successful in withholding, avoid reinstatement, and continue with a motion to reopen. I'm gonna ask Bob to talk about his case because I know he has a couple of very interesting cases in this exact procedural posture, so he can talk about what he's done there.
Yeah, we have one pending at the Ninth Circuit right now. It was just had oral argument recently. An interesting case. The person was deported prior to IIRA and then reentered, deported after IIRA, but the person was eligible for 212C relief. It's one of these cases. There have been several of them where the person was eligible or potentially eligible for 212C, and the immigration judge basically said, you're deportable, and the person was then deported from the United States, came back into the United States shortly after that, was recently prosecuted for reentry after deportation, and the district court judge found that there was a violation of due process in the underlying deportation proceedings. And then the question is whether you can file a motion to reopen and get the underlying deportation case reopened and have the client an opportunity to now apply for 212C relief, which he should have been given 20 years ago. In that case, another interesting aspect, and I've seen this also come up in several cases, where when the person is prosecuted for reentry after deportation and the case is dismissed, I think what you really need is a finding by the district court, a ruling by the district court, that the case should be dismissed under Section 1325. The statute requires a certain showing of a due process violation and prejudice, and whether that would collaterally stop the Immigration Service from reinstating prior deportation order. That is one particular issue that comes up in maybe not real often, but I've seen several of these cases like this, and whether the courts are going to require, as we're hoping comes out of the Ninth Circuit here, require the Immigration Service or EOIR to reopen the proceedings and give the person a chance to file for the benefit that he or she was or would have been eligible for back in the underlying proceedings that violated due process. I did want to talk we just have a couple minutes left, Laura. I did want to ask you a couple questions about motions to reopen based on ineffective assistance of counsel and whether what sort of considerations you might give in a case where one of your colleagues perhaps hasn't done a perfect representation, or I suppose we should say effective representation, perhaps missed a benefit that the person could have applied for, or perhaps didn't prepare adequately, or whatever the case may be. What about filing a motion to reopen based on IAC, ineffective assistance of counsel?
Sure, and I think actually you sort of hinted there's a range of reasons why somebody looking at a case, say, now that the the stay isn't being extended by ICE, and you're really under the gun, and we're trying to figure out, gosh, is there any way to, you know, prevent this removal? And you start digging through the case, and you know, you find something. And I think what we're all seeing these days is that you're finding sometimes that some things are, as Bob said initially, not perfect. Maybe somebody did a B-plus job on a case that needed, you know, A-level work. Or, you know, maybe you're just Monday morning quarterbacking. I would say that what we've been presenting today is, you know, essentially, look, business as usual, or what was business as usual up until the bad thing happened in November, it might not cut it. And so if you have something and you're kind of on the ropes, you are going to want to dig through the entire file and see if there's anything that you can point to that, you know, changed or might have changed the outcome in a case. We are obviously still finding plenty of examples where lawyers, or in some cases notarios that people thought were lawyers, have made errors, and the procedures under Lozada remain the same, at least for the time being. I think people should be aware of the fact that that EOIR has at various points in time wanted to move away from Lozada per se and to attempt to codify the bases for motions to reopen based on IAC. We first had this in Compion many years ago, and then Compion 1 and 2. There was a proposed rule that was published last summer, and I worry, given that you know, we have Jeff Sessions heading the Department of Justice and a whole new crew of people who are frankly very hostile to the due process rights of aliens in proceedings, heading EOIR, that our ability to bring those cases is going to become more and more narrow. But I think that you're going to find situations where you look at a case and you think, well, there but for the grace of God, or maybe it's just a difference in strategy, or it wasn't done quite as well as maybe Bob Powell would have done it. And, you know, hope that you've got enough there to convince somebody that there was a due process violation, that this person did not get their fair day in court. It may be just about the only thing you have left to you on a lot of these cases that we're seeing, where you're not going to get a stay. There's a final order, and nobody, you know, not only nobody cares about the impact on your client or his family, but the directive from headquarters and from all the way to the top is just to get people out of the country. We don't care how.
Okay, yeah, I think those are important considerations, and like as you suggest, Laura, I think more and more often we're going to have to be looking and thinking about motions to reopen and doing whatever we can to keep our clients here. I think we're out of time now. I just want to thank our audience for listening, and thank Laura and Matthew for your very, very helpful comments and guidance on these issues.
Thank you, Robert. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the four-digit code for attendance verification. The four-digit code is 1989. Again, the code is 1989. Please visit AILA's Web CLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much for all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise. That concludes our podcast.